surprised by Hegseth's decision, but it still speaks to the indifference of those who don't know their history.
It's despicable, it's untruthful, and insulting to our people.
In a press release, the Oglala Sioux tribe says descendants of those scarred by Wounded Knee have served honorably in every U.S. conflict from World War I to Afghanistan. And every year, an annual memorial rite is held to honor those killed at Wounded Knee. Again, Frank Starr comes out.
This is history. This is something that our people are traumatized with, and we have to live with that. And I keep saying this every time I go to Washington to advocate, not only for the Oglala Sioux tribe, and tribes nationwide. You know, we were never dealt a fair hand.
Meanwhile, the National Congress of American Indians has also denounced Hegseth's decision and are calling on the U.S. Congress to pass what's called the Remove the Stain Act, so that, quote, the nation's highest honor fulfills its namesake by reflecting courage, not cowardice and cruelty. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Belfast City Council in Ireland approved a historic policy for the island's indigenous language, as Sean McPullen reports.
Belfast City Councillors approved the new Irish language policy this week. It comes after years of advocacy and consultations with the indigenous language community. The city plans to redesign its logo to now include the original Irish spelling of Bailfirstia, which means mouth of the Sandbank Ford. The policy also pledges to ensure all city signs contain both languages. Far-right councillors tried to block the new policy, but were unsuccessful. The council previously earmarked the equivalent of $2.5 million to fund the changes, as well as new initiatives that remove barriers for the use of Irish in public life. The Irish language has been experiencing a renaissance of late, particularly among young speakers, in part thanks to the worldwide success of the Belfast band Kneecap. For National Native News, I'm Sean McPullen in Ireland.
The Cherokee Nation partnered with DreamWorks Animation and NBC Universal to dub the animated film How to Train Your Dragon in the Cherokee language. The Oklahoma tribe held a private screening of the film this week, which is streaming on Peacock. It's part of the tribe's Cherokee language preservation efforts. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 2nd, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Isabel Charlet, Eric Tegedoff, and Anna Wilcox. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. Our director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Fulham on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell, so glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. And if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth, next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Donald Trump's deeply troubling United Nations speech, China's weapons show, and Israel's genocide in Gaza and the latest peace plan. First, Trump's deeply troubling UN speech. Donald Trump's speech before the UN General Assembly September 23rd was filled with self-congratulation, gross misstatements of fact, and past grievances. In other words, the usual. the speech showed Trump at his worst, and it was an embarrassment for the United States and a humiliating experience for the UN, which he derided. Trump falsely presented himself as a peacemaker and the UN as an organization that just, quote, writes letters. His failures in the Ukraine and Gaza wars went unmentioned, of course. Most disturbing of Trump's remarks were those concerning immigrants and climate change. He castigated Europe for allowing so many immigrants in, saying, "Your countries are going to hell." "European prisons are mostly populated by immigrants," he said. "It's an invasion, and Europe is destroying itself," a projection of his view of migrants here. On climate change, he made the usual absurd charges: that predictions of a climate crisis haven't proven out. "It's the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world," he said. That renewable energy is, quote, "a joke. It doesn't work. Too expensive." That the Chinese don't like wind power. That Europe and Germany in particular are, quote, "on the brink of destruction because of the green energy agenda." U.S. air quality, said Trump, is being ruined by other countries' pollution and garbage. He touted U.S. coal, which he said is clean, beautiful, and which just days later led to the administration's removal of federal regulations on coal extraction and burning. About the only positive I could find in Trump's speech was in reference to weapons of mass destruction. He said, quote, "We need to have a cessation of the development of nuclear weapons. The U.S., he said, will lead an international effort to enforce the Biological Weapons Convention by pioneering an AI verification system that everyone can trust," unquote. Let's see if anything of the sort happens. China's weapons show. What to make of China's massive display of its military arsenal on September 2nd, marking the end of World War II in the Pacific? Many observers concluded that China now is the most powerful presence in Asia. Others see the parade of weapons as a warning to the U.S. and the West. Still others see defensiveness as the chief motive. China won't be bullied, in short. The fact that Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un were in attendance is noteworthy. China may have wanted to show that it has the military power and therefore has their back, at least in theory. As for the weapons, lots of new ones were on display, including hypersonic missiles and unmanned aircraft, altogether six different categories of weapons. The International Institute of Strategic Studies examined the nuclear triad that China was displaying for the first time. Generally, the weapons showcased are already deployed or close to it, but some military experts note that China may have paraded weapons that are not yet available. One argument being advanced is that the military parade showed that China has taken the lead in advanced weapons technology and thus is changing the military balance of power in Asia-Pacific. It is no longer enough to say that China's military, the People's Liberation Army, is catching up or that it is copying foreign military equipment designs, says one observer. China is now innovating and it is leading. In the process, the regional military balance that has for decades favored the U.S. and its partners is being irrevocably changed. I think there's reason to dispute that conclusion, however. For one thing, weapons aren't the sole determining factor in the balance of power. The Chinese would be the first to say that. Man over weapons has been the People's Liberation Army's mantra since Mao's time. Morale, leadership, strategy, including strategic innovation, and allies are all important pieces in the balance. And China may be wanting in all these other areas. Since October 2022, M. Taylor Fravel, an expert on China's military, writes, Xi Jinping has fired more than 20 senior officers in the PLA. The purges, quote, are likely to slow some weapons modernization programs, disrupt command structures and decision-making, and weaken morale, all of which would degrade the PLA's ability to fight in the near to medium term. Next, Israel's genocide in Gaza and the latest peace plan. The Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, which was established by the UN Human Rights Council in 2021, has issued a devastating report which concludes that Israel is guilty of genocide in Gaza. It is a careful legal analysis that, in conformity with the UN Convention on Genocide, to which Israel is a party, not only details the destruction of lives and property in Gaza, but also the intention of Israeli leaders to commit genocide. Craig Muckheiber, an international human rights lawyer and former senior UN official, was interviewed on PBS about the report. He said it, quote, follows up on earlier findings of genocide by the UN Special Rapporteur. virtually the entire community of international human rights lawyers, we have never seen a consensus as clear as this one. And now this additional report on top of that, a very serious, officially mandated report, I think is the final piece in the puzzle of accountability that people have been trying to build for 2 years of genocide. Navi Pillay, the commission head, writes in a New York Times opinion piece, quote, "What does this mean for the international community? It means its obligations are not optional. Every state has an obligation to prevent genocide wherever it occurs. That obligation requires action, halting the transfer of weapons and military support used in genocidal acts, ensuring unimpeded humanitarian assistance, stopping the mass displacement and destruction, and using all available diplomatic and legal means to stop the killing. To do nothing is not neutrality, it is complicity," unquote. And when it comes to complicity, the Trump administration must be put at the top of the list. He has disclaimed any interest in trying to restrain Netanyahu or even awareness of the latest offensive in Gaza. "Well, I have to see," he said. "I don't know too much about it." Thus, Trump has turned his back on genocide, just as have his predecessors. Several Western countries have not turned their backs, at least not on the idea of a Palestinian state. France, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, and Portugal have all granted recognition. They are among 149 countries that have done so. Still, the future of a Palestinian state looks very dim. Trump's so-called peace plan, which is actually Netanyahu's, mentions a Palestinian state, but the operative conditions of the plan offer little hope, since it calls for a long-term Israeli security presence in Gaza, offers nothing for Gaza's reconstruction, and says nothing about Israel's increasingly forceful occupation of the West Bank. 760,000 people, according to Israeli Defense Forces, have fled Gaza City to the south, where relief conditions are reportedly atrocious. The peace plan has a dubious proposal for a transitional governing authority in the Gaza Strip, with Trump as chairman and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, infamous supporter of George W. Bush's Iraq War, as the main player. Netanyahu reiterated last month that he would never permit a separate Palestinian state, and his continuation in power depends on his not wavering from that position. In other news, a Russian plot against Moldova fails. Maia Sandu, the president of Moldova, which borders Ukraine to the southwest, had warned that her country's independence and European future were in danger after police arrested dozens of people accused of involvement in a plot to stoke violent disorder, allegedly backed by Russia. Just days before the September 28 parliamentary elections, Moldovan police said they had confiscated weapons and explosives in raids across the country. Addressing the nation, President Sandu accused the Kremlin of, quote, pouring hundreds of millions of euros into Moldova in an attempt to foment violence and spread disinformation and fear. "The Kremlin believes that we are all for sale, that we are all too small to resist, that we are not a country, only a territory." And she pointed to Russian involvement at the highest level. "But Moldova is our home, and our home is not for sale." A Russian plot was evidently not a theory. The BBC reported, quote, "Using an undercover reporter, we discovered the Russian-funded network promised to pay participants if they posted pro-Russian propaganda and fake news undermining Moldova's pro-European Union ruling party ahead of the parliamentary elections. That party, known as the PAS, won 50.2% of the vote versus only 24.2% for the Patriotic Bloc, which had sought to steer Moldova closer to Russia. Among those congratulating Moldova were the leaders of France, Germany, and Poland. In a joint statement, they cited, quote, the peaceful conduct of the election, despite unprecedented interference by Russia, including with vote-buying schemes and disinformation. Finally, on the environmental front, I have three important stories. First, China's super dam in the Himalayas poses a major environmental danger. China is investing around $170 billion to build a massive dam on the Brahmaputra River in Tibet. The location in one of the world's most seismically active zones could make the dam an environmental disaster. "Constructing the world's largest dam atop a geological fault line is more than reckless," says one expert. "It is a calculated gamble with catastrophic potential. Any collapse, whether from structural weakness or reservoir-induced seismicity, would devastate India's northeast and Bangladesh, placing tens of millions at risk. The stakes extend beyond Asia, he adds. Tibet is warming twice as fast as the global average, accelerating glacier melt and permafrost thaw. With its towering height rising into the troposphere, the Tibetan plateau shapes the Asian monsoons, stabilizes climate across Eurasia, and influences the Northern Hemisphere's atmospheric general circulation. The second story concerns the latest scientific findings on the dangers of greenhouse gases. A report published by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine flies in the face of the Trump administration's efforts to revoke a landmark scientific determination known as the endangerment finding that underpins the federal government's legal authority to control the pollution that is driving climate change. That finding, which originated in 2009, is central to the Clean Air Act's environmental regulations. If a court were to side with the administration, it would gut all efforts to deal with the climate crisis. The report is the work of 24 scientists. It reaffirms the well-known dangers of greenhouse gases and presents new dangers to public health from them. Climate change, the scientists find, is exacerbating a wide variety of health risks, like intense heat waves and increased wildfire smoke. Climate-driven changes in temperature and rainfall patterns have also led to negative effects on crops and less water availability in some places, among other disruptions. The Times notes that in response to the report, Carolyn Holren, an EPA spokeswoman, said, quote, "The endangerment finding has been used by the Obama and Biden administrations to justify trillions of dollars of greenhouse gas regulations covering new motor vehicles and new motor vehicle engines. As we saw in the 16 intervening years since the endangerment finding was made, many of the extremely pessimistic predictions and assumptions EPA relied upon have not materialized as expected," unquote. Really? The revisionist work of the Environmental Protection Agency and the Energy Department will be decided in court. One expert predicts that, quote, "courts are going to be very leery if the EPA tries to ignore or reject the findings of the National Academies of Sciences." But while the legal process unfolds, scientists in some parts of the EPA are being told to stop seeking publication of their work. At the EPA's Office of Water, the Washington Post reports, quote, "researchers were told that unless scientific journals had already returned proofs, the final step in the academic publishing process, the studies would be subject to a new review process," the employees said. In other words, official censorship seeks to quell scientific findings. And finally, coral reefs in the Atlantic Ocean are in deep peril. Analysis of over 400 existing coral reefs across the Atlantic Ocean estimates that more than 70% of the region's reefs will begin dying by 2040, even under optimistic climate warming scenarios. And if the planet exceeds 2 degrees Celsius of warming above pre-industrial temperatures by the end of the century, 99% of corals in the region would meet this fate. That outcome would put an end to a significant portion of ocean life and affect the livelihoods of millions of people. Sea levels would also rise more quickly if corals are dying. Scientists are considering various ways to restore corals in endangered areas, such as the Caribbean. But, quote, "we can't assume that if we restore the corals of the past, they will be able to cope with the conditions of the future," said Andrew Baker, a marine ecologist at the University of Miami. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Kevin Foster is an independent journalist who has covered the immigration protests at the McAdam ICE facility. He was in Los Angeles earlier this summer covering demonstrations and community activism. We asked him about different types of community organizing strategies he witnessed in LA.
I did a little trip through California and basically mostly San Francisco and Los Angeles in early August, and went and covered community activism. It was really interesting to see so many different groups coming together, a lot of decentralized autonomous groups that were, you know, they were, whether it's setting up a resource tent at a Home Depot and trying to help day laborers and keep them from getting taken by ICE, or, it's people that roam neighborhoods in their cars. I think there were quite a few different things that activists were doing that it seemed like a lot of people in LA said was really effective at slowing ICE down.
Strategies, he said, ranged from simpler things like boycotts to more complex activism.
The things that I found that maybe not as, that I haven't really necessarily seen in Portland, and this is partially, I think, because just Portland hasn't, and I think this is something people are worried about with the crackdown, is Portland hasn't necessarily seen like a ton of wide scale raids. There are definitely people being taken and it's usually reported. A lot of the time we see it from places like Beaverton. But in Los Angeles, I mean, they sent in federal troops and this all started with, I think, a massive raid that launched, kicked everything off, and there were huge protests, and enough that the protests could be sort of decentralized across multiple locations, and that the police openly said it's a lot harder for them to handle 10 different protests with 1,000 people than one protest with 10,000. You know, I talked to a few people that had been organizing around the just recovery from the Altadena fires in near Pasadena. There was sort of this understanding of a need to shift gears into organizing for immigrants instead of just the fires. And it's obviously hard to deal with just everybody's capacity to do things, but the community defense corners, that's a big thing that I saw at a few Home Depots, but there was one in Pasadena that I think they got some maybe national coverage somewhere, but they basically, it started off with community patrols. Just people would go through the parking lot and try to keep an eye out for ICE and trying to give some sort of security to the day laborers. And then it went to a tent that they set up where volunteers would come and essentially staff that during the work week. And they'd have resources, they'd talk to the day laborers, build community around that. And that Home Depot, as far as I know, was the last Home Depot raided in LA. It wasn't raided until mid-August, until after I had actually left. And then like if ICE does show up, they'll go and document and film. Depending on the group, they might try to disrupt. It kind of depends on what people want to do, what they're willing to risk. There was, you know, people, rapid response groups that you have an app or a group chat in your neighborhood and you get warnings and watch out for signs of ICE. And then if there is ICE, you know, basically trying to get people on the scene as fast as possible to document it. That one's, you know, it's really difficult to organize that on a large scale, but it's, in essence, I feel like it's relatively simple in some ways. But there was stuff like the immigration court in San Francisco, where they were going on the days where they felt like people were, where they seemed like the days ICE was making more arrests. I think it was Tuesday, I believe, at first, and then they expanded to Fridays. But you know, it takes a lot of capacity to be there all the time. And basically, they would just go sit outside the immigration court, do a little rally, try to help make people coming to their court hearings more comfortable and be there to document or, again, potentially disrupt ICE. I know there as well, that also resulted in some pretty violent arrests by federal agents in the part of the week where I was in LA. It was definitely interesting seeing a lot of these groups. Like, I would either talk to them and then 3 days later they were getting arrested or dealing with a lot of intense activity, or I'd be going to a group and then something would happen. And There's like Unión del Barrio is a big organization in San Diego, Los Angeles, that they've been doing a lot of work around trying to protect immigrants, especially in that kind of rapid response neighborhood watch documenting. So they've been, and there's a whole lot that goes into documenting as well, but I think PERC, Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition, has a lot of good resources on that.
Foster said they have been to the Portland ICE facility a few times this summer. However, demonstrations in front of the facility have been happening for over 100 days. Typically around 30 individuals gather in front of the facility. During larger demonstrations, crowd have surpassed a few hundred.
I think for the most part, a lot of the time it's pretty chill and it's just people out there. I'm sure there's like, DHS could try to say that they're provoking by not moving, like not actively clearing the way. When all the DHS agents come out, they come out and they push people and they open up. A lot of the time it's to get cars in or out of the facility. Although, at least when I was there on the No Kings Day, it was like, you know, it's a little while ago, but if I'm remembering right, like they would kind of just come out, they would throw a bunch of tear gas, push people, they arrested some people and dragged them into the building.
Last week, Foster shared videos of two demonstrators being taken into custody by federal officers.
At the times that I've gone down, I've tried to interview a number of different people on the ground, potentially from different groups. I've gotten some pretty intense footage of ICE or DHS or, you know, whatever three-letter acronym there is that is down there out at the time. Some pretty brutal arrests that they've done. In pretty much all the instances that I've seen, it hasn't really been clear to me why the people are arrested. I don't know if there's some sort of camera system and they decide. But yeah, I think from my experience, I mean, a lot of people on the ground have been saying that it's just, they kind of just come out willy-nilly and pick somebody and they make an arrest. And then in a lot of instances, this results in somebody being dragged or carried. I'm not a good judge of distance, but like a number of like 50 plus feet into the building. It's definitely some rough stuff to see. And like, I imagine it's definitely very hard on the activists down there.
Although Foster has not been at the Portland facility regularly, he opened up about the emotional toll of his coverage.
It's very scary, especially in June. I think like for me, it was really scary seeing, like, I definitely had at least pepper ball, like, guns pointed up in my direction. A guy got shot in the eye that I interviewed with a tear gas canister. Yeah, it's a lot.
Foster told us that some of the most distressing moments he witnessed occurred in LA.
I mean, it's been a challenge for me, for sure. I don't think I fully conceptualized how much of an emotional toll that trip took until I was leaving. I was down at the detention center there. I saw like maybe one of the most, at least in terms of something that I was there to film, probably the most brutal arrest that I've seen I think it was a young photographer that was taking, I mean, he was getting in the faces of some of the DHS agents, but he seemingly was trying to get their faces for documentation purposes. And yeah, it was really violent. And then after that, the protests got bigger, and then LAPD came through and beat a bunch of press people with batons. They arrested some, they kettled them. I think there was an LA Times article about it. It's ironic that you need a temporary restraining order to say that LAPD and DHS can't assault the press. And then it's even worse when they violate that restraining order. And luckily it does, the LA Press Club is really well organized, and it seems like they're winning, or at least they have a preliminary injunction against both LAPD and DHS to stopping them from using crowd controls. And I think there's more protections for press and legal observers as well. But
Covering stories that are underreported is important to Foster.
I've been kind of independent freelancing for about 2 years, and I think I got into it covering a lot of pro-Palestine activism and just seeing how deeply misunderstood a lot of that movement was and how often it was misrepresented. Telling people stories that don't necessarily get the attention that they deserve, telling stories that are either oftentimes misrepresented or that people won't get to see. And it just means something to get to go and talk to people about their lives and what they're struggling with, and, you know, share that with others. I think that we can become very segmented sometimes in society, and seeing that everybody has a story to tell and something going on, I think is really valuable. And even whether that's at an ICE facility and people are struggling trying to protect immigrants in that way, or if it's the unions at Portland State University having difficult contract negotiations. I think there's quite a few different stories that aren't always going to make it into the spotlight, and so that's kind of my goal as a journalist.
Foster is the creator of The Palestine Exception, a documentary film made here in Portland. For KBOO, I'm Anna Wilcox.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are feeling sad, struggling with alcohol or drug use, or just need someone to talk to. Trained counselors are able to listen